My name is Anthony King, and I'm telling the stories behind your favorite cop movies. This is the all-new Neon Badges. In 1981, a young director by the name of Abel Ferrara met a 17-year-old girl named Zoe Tamerlis, a brilliant young woman who spoke several different languages and was considered a musical prodigy on scholarship to Columbia. They made a movie together about a mute seamstress who's raped twice and then goes on a revenge-driven killing spree called Miss 45. Variety called it short and busy, saying there are enough gross elements to separate thrill-seeking viewers from traditionalists. After that, Abel and Zoe had a falling out and didn't really speak for about 10 years until they connected and made another movie that included a nun being raped. 8 years after making their second film together, Zoe was dead and Abel moved to Europe soon after. But let's start at the beginning. Abel Ferrara was born in the Bronx, later moving to Peekskill, New York, where he spent most of his childhood. He attended Rockland Community College and started making short films, later being accepted into the Film Conservatory at Purchase College in New York. After graduating from film school in 1976, Abel and his friend, Nicholas St. John, were short on work. So, Abel created the pseudonym Jimmy Boy L, and like many filmmakers of the time, they made a porno film and called it Nine Lives of a Wet Pussy. After that, Abel and St. John made a low-budget grindhouse slasher film called The Driller Killer, about a struggling artist who, you guessed it, kills people with a power drill. The Driller Killer ended up being banned in the UK as part of the Video Nasties, movies deemed too grotesque and violent for the general public. In America, though, it was a different story. This ultra-indie exploitation film, shot on 16mm in and around Abel's apartment for no money, started gaining Abel some attention. He considered it a documentary of the time they were living in, saying, "It was a world we were trying to be a part of. We wanted to put our movies in theaters. Those were the movies people were watching, and we put two and two together."
The Driller Killer is coming.
Abel followed Driller Killer up with Miss 45, where he met his future collaborator Zoe. But as I said, after production, they seemed to have a falling out. Abel says Zoe had traveled Europe at a young age and hooked up with the crowd and got strung out. Zoe's former lovers and friends say differently, though. But one thing was agreed upon, Zoe loved drugs. Heroin, specifically. She even advocated for recreational heroin use. It was the elixir of life for her, says Abel. But in that time when Abel and Zoe weren't speaking, Abel made four movies. Fear City, with Tom Berenger and Billy Dee Williams as detectives searching for a serial killer targeting strippers. China Girl, an absolutely brilliant take on Romeo and Juliet. Cat Chaser, starring Peter Weller as a hotel owner having an affair with the wife of a psychotic Dominican general. And King of New York, with Christopher Walken as a drug kingpin recently released from prison. From the beginning, Abel was and continues to be a very competent, brilliant even, filmmaker. One thing was certain, he had a vision and he knew how to put it on celluloid. The thematic string that connects all of his movies is this. They frequently deal with the messiness of morality. There's violence and addiction in his stories, but also occasional glimmers of goodness and redemption. Throw in a song and a true crime story, Abel was headed towards his reconnection with Zoe. October 10th, 1981, a 31-year-old nun at the Sisters of Charity convent next to Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church in East Harlem was beaten, raped, and tortured. Mayor Ed Koch called it a despicable act of depravity and said he wanted to see the guy hung. It was a huge story in one of the most violent years in New York City history. It was a tragedy, says Abel. It stuck with everyone in the city at that time. And it became the main crime around which Bad Lieutenant revolves. Again, stories differ as to who actually wrote the script for Lieutenant, but for the sake of argument, I'm saying Zoe wrote it. Now, to kill time, Abel and writer-director Menno Meyas would come up with these crazy, unrelated ideas and vignettes. The idea for Lieutenant actually came out of one of those sessions. First as a song, but Abel had always thought of it as a comedy. A dark comedy, but still a comedy. You have this guy, a cop, who has every single type of vice you could think of. Drugs, alcohol, gambling, women. So after Abel and Zoe reconciled, she set off on writing a script. Having grown up in the Catholic Church, and as you see with most of Abel's films, there would be some sort of religious aspect. Zoe, on the other hand, never went through that experience. Although, she says, any sort of knowledge regarding religion is a personal journey quite resembling any sort of quest for truth. So I put that into the character of LT. Zoe nor Abel ever considered this to be a cop movie per se. Sure, our main character has the job of a police detective and he's trying to solve this horrible crime, but it was always going to be a character study of this fragile, broken man. Zoe said, the idea of LT being so corrupt allowed him to be closer to humility. Someone like that would be in touch with their humanity, bringing them closer to their community. LT is more human than corrupt. So they had this rock and roll cop who's charming, a real screw-up, but generally succeeds at his job. And while this was to be a character study instead of a cop film, they still needed a crime to put into the background. Abel contacted Bo Dietl, who was in charge of the original Nun case back in 1981. He said he wanted to do something based on the case. Dietl goes,
wait a minute, this guy won't be based on me, will he?
Of course not, says Abel. So Dietl came on board as a technical advisor and actually appears in the film. Around that same time, Zoe finishes the screenplay, which was about 68 pages long. It wasn't very good, says Abel. And think about this for a minute. One page of a script generally equals about a minute. The first draft was 68 pages, just barely over an hour. And then look at the runtime of the final cut of the film, 96 minutes, or roughly 96 pages of script. How? Well, we're going to get there in a minute. With the script finished, Abel's wife got nervous. This is going to be the most depraved movie of his career. She knew how far he'd dive in, the lengths he'd go to inhabit these characters along with his actors, and it would be a tough hole to climb out of. So Abel promised his wife he wouldn't direct it. Well. So now came the worst part of filmmaking, finding the money to make this picture. Abel had two of his producers from King of New York, Mary Kane and Randy Sabasawa, on board, but spent a couple years searching for more people who would finance his film. The drawback for everyone they spoke to was the rating. Abel and his team knew from the beginning this was going to be an NC-17 picture. That was the plan all along. There just wasn't any other way to tell the story they wanted to tell. Abel's DP, Ken Kelsch, said they were offered a lot of money. Other guys would offer us three times the amount we actually got if we made an R-rated picture. And that right there is Abel. The no-holds-barred approach is what really makes his movies survive. From the script level, sure, but also the approach they took to filming it. Abel's editor, Anthony Redman, read the script and thought, what the fuck is this shit? Sabasawa said the pre-production seemed endless. Eventually, though, they landed Edward R. Pressman, who had produced several hits including Badlands, Phantom of the Paradise, Das Boot, the two Conan films, Wall Street, and Blue Steel, to name a few. So now it was time to find the titular character of LT. The original plan was to have Christopher Walken play LT. Walken had just done King with Abel and they had developed a great relationship with one another. But after reading the script, Walken told Abel,
I know what you're looking for and I just can't do it.
And that was that, Abel said. With those guys, you don't argue. Anthony Redman said Walken was too elegant anyways. Harvey? Now he's not elegant. Harvey Keitel was born in Brooklyn in 1939, the son of Jewish immigrants. His parents owned a luncheonette and his father worked as a hat maker. At 16, Harvey enlisted in the Marines and after being discharged, worked as a court reporter for several years and eventually started acting. He studied under some of the greatest acting instructors of all time, including Stella Adler, Lee Strasberg, and at HB Studio. If you recall from the Cruising episode, Al Pacino also studied at HB with Strasberg. Harvey was doing roles in off-Broadway productions when he auditioned for Martin Scorsese, scoring a starring role in Who's That Knocking at My Door. Harvey was then cast as Captain Willard in Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now, but after the first week of principal photography, was fired because Coppola wasn't happy with the direction Harvey was taking the character. The role of Willard was then, of course, given to Martin Sheen. Harvey then went on to a dozen other films, including Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ, The January Man, Jack Nicholson's The Two Jakes, Ridley Scott's Thelma and Louise, and Barry Levinson's Bugsy, which earned him a Best Supporting Oscar. When Harvey got the script of Bad Lieutenant, he read 10 pages and then threw it in the trash. But his friend and Abel's frequent collaborator, Victor Argo, came to the rescue and convinced Harvey to give it another shot. This time around, he saw something in it that was apparent. He agreed to do the picture, but first he had to shoot a little film for a young director named Quentin Tarantino.
For the past 15 minutes now, you've been droning on about names. Toby Wong. Toby Chung, fucking Charlie Chan. We've got Madonna's big dick coming out of my left ear, and Toby the Jet, I don't know what, coming out of my right.
The quality I most admire about Abel Ferrara is his preparedness. He says spending time preparing is not expensive. Develop the characters in rehearsals. assemble a crew you trust and believe in, and maybe the most important thing, scout locations. Know exactly what you have to work with in that space so you don't waste time on shooting day figuring out blocking or where you could place the camera. Know your locations. Luckily, they were shooting in Abel's and Kelsch's backyard, New York City. They'd be filming outside of the school Abel went to as a kid. LT's house was located in Mars Park in the Bronx. They'd be shooting at actual crack dens on the Lower East Side in Uptown. Alphabet City, Bellevue Hospital. The church was in Jersey City. And they'd be using Mickey Rourke's suite at the Mayflower Hotel. So Harvey finishes Dogs and started digging into LT. Production designer Charles Lagola said when he first met Harvey before they started production that he was already starting to transform into this character. DP Ken Kelsch said he didn't think anyone could pull it off. Harvey did. He was going through some serious life situations at the time, and in his own personal way, Abel says, directed all of his problems at the character. Now remember, Zoe's script was bare bones, which left a lot up to the actors, meaning improvisation. Back to his preparedness, Abel would rehearse his actors. A lot. Remember on the last episode how Pacino never knew his lines or knew what was happening each day on the set of Cruising? And how he just wanted to jump in front of the camera and improv his way through the scenes? And how Friedkin said the only way to do that is to actually know the script? Yeah, this wasn't like that at all. Rehearse it again. Got it? Good. Rehearse it again. Penny Allen was Harvey's acting coach at the time. Ironically, she was Pacino's too. And she was with Harvey throughout the entire process. Abel said she was essential. The film couldn't have been made without her. So they knew the script backwards and forwards and sideways and inside and outside, and that's what allowed them the breathing room they needed to fill in the rest. And Abel's advice to everyone on set? The simpler it is, the stronger it is. Principal Photography began on October 8th, 1991. By strange coincidence, this was 2 days shy of the 10th anniversary of the original assault on the nun in 1981. They shot the first crime scene that appears in the movie that day with Harvey, Argo, Paul Calderon, and a few other actors playing detectives, and then filled in the rest with actual cops, including Bo Dietl. For the onlookers, production didn't go about hiring extras. They just set up the scene and started rolling. Whoever was there to watch ended up being in the movie. Abel says, you're better off with real people looking in the camera than extras trying to act like bystanders. And that was he and Ken Kelsch's approach to the camera. Kelsch had been Abel's cinematographer since The Driller Killer, so they knew how to work together. They wanted to go in with a documentary style of camera work, with the goal of never having the camera be judgmental. We, the audience, aren't being told what to believe. We're just along for the ride, watching these events unfold. Harvey stayed in character the whole time on set, method acting, which is what Strasberg taught. Kelsch remembers one time he tried to fix Harvey's collar and Harvey yelled at him. Kenny never messed with him again after that. Since 30% of the script would be improvised, and really probably over half the movie is improvised, Kelsch would just strap on his camera or set up a tripod and let it roll. They'd be shooting on 1,000-foot magazines of 35mm film, which run about 11 minutes, and would roll for hours and hours a day, loading and reloading magazines until they ran out of all the film they had for that day. None of it was scripted. Most of the time, they didn't even know what Harvey was going to do. One of the two most infamous scenes in Bad Lieutenant comes in the first act where LT's drinking himself silly while having a threesome with two women. Harvey, the 50-year-old sex symbol, as Kelsch says. As is the case on most sets during a nude scene, it was very private. They were shooting in the penthouse at the Mayflower, and the actors were given as much time as they needed to work everything out. The two women, Harvey, his acting coach, and a skeleton crew spent hours upon hours in that room that day. The only thing in the script was a simple description. What you see in the final film are three very dedicated actors bearing it all for their art. Naturally, shooting permits were completely out of the question. See, legally, what you're supposed to do is apply for a permit to shoot wherever you're filming. If granted, then you pay a fee and you have a scheduled amount of time to shoot there. Sometimes, though, to make the art you want to make, you just can't abide by any one set of rules. All this to say, most of the shots in Bad Lieutenant are stolen, meaning the actors and crew show up whenever and wherever and just start filming. For many films, including this one, it's essential to the story to not get those permits. If you're going for a specific tone or feeling, or want natural reactions, you just need to go out and shoot the scene. So scenes like the club, where LT walks in and works his way through all those dancing bodies? No permit. Just Harvey, Kelsch, and Abel walking into the limelight and pushing people out of the way in order to get their shot. With the strobing lights and near pitch black room, Kelsch was worried about lighting. Abel, how dark are we allowed to have this film be? There's gonna be several seconds of black screen. Abel says, Kenny, he's in every fucking scene. We know what the guy looks like. Or the short scene where LT walks into Bellevue Hospital? No permits. In fact, Abel and Kelch didn't even know what the hell Harvey was going to do. Watch, and you'll notice almost everyone in that scene staring directly into the camera, just watching it walk by, wondering, what in the hell's going on here? Harvey said, follow me. So Kelch just strapped the camera to his shoulder and off they went. This thing was all chaos, Kelch says. And how about that ending where LT takes the two suspects to Port Authority? No permits. Abel says, if you don't ask, they can't say no, right? Or when LT pulls up in his car and we see the camera move towards him, that's because Harvey couldn't find a closer parking spot, so Kelch just picked up the tripod and started walking towards him. And then watch as LT walks the two suspects into the terminal, and a real Port Authority cop holds the door for him and follows him in, thinking he's actually helping out another cop. Again, no permits for outside the bus there, as LT's scolding the two rapists, telling them never to come back. Now, this was the first day of shooting for those two actors, so earlier in the day, Harvey taught them both how to take a slap just in case it got to that point. After all, Harvey's improvising that whole thing. Who knows what the hell's gonna happen? One of those guys was an actual actor. The other guy? Well, he ended up just driving his friend to the audition one day and got the gig. In the actual rape scene, these poor guys were so scared and Abel had to keep telling him, be more aggressive! It doesn't look real! So for the final shot, Kelch set up his camera in the back of a truck across the street from the Port Authority bus terminal. No permits, of course, so in that scene, the car pulls up to LT's, pop pop, he's dead, and then people gather around. Now, that first lady who goes up to the car is a paid extra. See, they were shooting in New York City and they knew if they didn't at least have somebody creating some sort of excitement, nobody would notice. They just keep walking by. Oh look, another dead body. So this lady's out there waving her arms, she's waving people over. Somebody help, I think this man's dead. And you have Abel off camera on the sidewalk saying, oh my god, I think somebody just got shot. So what you're seeing in the final shot are real people and real reactions, including the cop who walks up at the very end. Now this cop isn't part of the production, but he can see that it's all fake. So he starts saying, move along guys, would you stop screwing around and get out of here, fucking amateurs. And then there's the most infamous scene that is understandably hard to watch for many people. LT pulls over the two girls going back to Jersey after a night of partying. He threatens them with jail time if they don't do something for him. In Zoe's original script, all it said was he blackmails them into humiliating sex scenes on a side street off 11th Avenue. LT plays it out until dawn. Zoe actually directed the girls in this scene and says there was a lot of tequila involved. Everyone had a general idea of how the scene would play out, but nobody expected what they ended up with. Abel told Kelch just to set the camera up and no matter what he does, get it. Harvey did what he did. He surprised everyone by taking it to a whole new perverse level.
Come on, give us a break. Couldn't you just give us a warning for not having for the taillight and let us go home?
Well, you know something, two such beautiful girls like you, I could give you a warning. You want a warning? Well, here's the warning. You do something for me, and I'll do something for you. What do you say about that? You do something for me, and your father won't find out you took his car and you're driving without a license.
Another scene that took place at the Mayflower is when LT visits Zoe, first to smoke crack and the second time to shoot up heroin. During the heroin scene, which, by the way, was all improvised by Harvey and Zoe actually came up with her vampire speech 2 minutes before walking in front of the camera. Anyways, during that scene, they had a nurse on set in case anything happened. They were actually just injecting saline solution, but still, they were inserting needles into their fucking arms. Script supervisor Karen Kelsall said it was scary good. You feel like you're shooting up with them. And maybe you'll notice the shot of Zoe shooting up is a little out of focus. That's because the assistant cameraman got physically ill watching her. The funny thing is, they ended up filming at the Mayflower for 5 days, and only about 2 minutes of it shows up in the final cut. Baseball plays a pretty big part in the film. Being a Mets fan, Abel wanted LT's gambling problems to revolve around the NLCS between the Mets and the Dodgers. While the Mets and Dodgers did play in the 88 LCS, they ended up taking highlights from different games between the two teams from the previous couple of years and formed their own series for the movie. Bob Murphy was the play-by-play announcer for the Mets, so Abel asked if he could record the part of the TV announcer for their fictional series. No lines were written. Abel just gave Murphy the scenario. Murphy went into a room in his house with a tape recorder and recorded himself calling these fictional plays and sent Abel the tape. And for the scene in the church, production designer Charles Lagola and his set dresser went in and carefully started decimating the sanctuary. They realized they were being blasphemous inside a Catholic church and they felt so guilty. So Abel had to push and push them to be badder than they could be. Lagola and his team needed that urging to be able to spray paint the word fuck over that altar. So what they did was cover everything in clear plastic film and then splash blood and graffiti the mosaic. Production shot for 20 days. Now, to give you a frame of reference, RoboCop was shot over 75 days, Seven over 55 days. Narc even had 28 days to shoot. Being able to shoot an entire feature-length film in less than 3 weeks is almost a miracle. It's only possible, though, with Abel's meticulous planning. That didn't mean things still weren't tight. For instance, the apartment LT goes to get his cut of the drug money had been painted and decorated by Lagola. Abel and Kelsch and the actors came in just as Lagola was finishing up and ended up shooting that scene while the paint on the walls was still wet. Scenes in the Mayflower had wallpaper peeling off the wall, not for any aesthetic purposes, but because Lagola had just thrown some up and they needed a shoot right away. Any shot of the city passing by, someone is driving, is just Kenny Kelsch filming on his way home from the set. They filmed whenever and wherever they could, and they only had one day to shoot with the crane. It was this homemade Bertha crane somebody had loaned them, so Kelsch would be down on the ground struggling to crank the thing by hand to get it to move up and down. The dedication the cast and crew had to this film speaks volumes to how much they all love and respect Abel Ferrara. Anthony Redmond had been Abel's editor since Fear City, but had also cut films like Joel Schumacher's The Incredible Shrinking Woman, Lone Wolf McQuaid, and Eric Wolf's Body Parts. According to Redmond, you want that first cut of the film done as soon as they're done with principal photography. He says when you're working on features, you try to get 2 good minutes per day of shooting. Unfortunately for him, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, he only had 20 days of film with which to work. So Redmond worked his magic. He depended on Kelsch's long takes and wouldn't use any type of intercutting. Redmond told Abel, "I hope focus isn't a big deal for you, and if it is, we're fucked." Well, it turns out some of that stuff was the best stuff. Harvey's freakouts, Zoe shooting up, some of the crime scenes. It was a little soft in focus, but he realized they were shooting under the most extreme conditions, and in the end, those soft moments just add to the final product. Other than several minutes cut from the scene where LT's eavesdropping in on the confessional, the final cut is practically Redmond's first cut. It was also decided there wasn't going to be much music in the film. They'd open and close the film with Johnny Ace's Pledging My Love, and they'd have Abel's song, The Bad Lieutenant, play over the end credits. Abel always felt too much scoring would take away from the vibe of the film, and this was a call made early in pre-production. But for what score would be there, Abel contacted his friend and frequent collaborator Joe Delia. Delia had worked with Abel on 9 Lives of Wet Pussy, The Driller Killer, Miss 45, China Girl, and King of New York. Not only that, Delia was an accomplished musician who was in touring bands for Stevie Wonder, Chuck Berry, the Isley Brothers, and in studio bands for Pat Benatar, Dusty Springfield, and Engelbert Humperdinck. For Lieutenant, though, Delia did real minimal scoring and ended up rearranging and re-recording an old World War I song that plays on the TV in LT's house. Abel had final cut on this picture, which meant he decided when it was ready for the public eye, as opposed to a producer or studio having the final word. And to this day, Abel still has final cut on all of his movies, one of the last directors with that opportunity. That's a rare thing, Abel says, because every movie is a battle and you can't even get that language in a contract anymore, which is why he moved to Europe to make movies. So the movie was cut and finished, and everyone was happy. Producer Randy Sabasao was proud of the film they just made for less than $2 million. He just wasn't sure what people would think. Bad Lieutenant screened in the Un Certain Regard section at the 1992 Cannes Film Festival. Abel was blown away by the great reception it received in France. It opened later that year in New York, but never received a wide release due to its NC-17 rating, and that was completely expected. On the other hand, European audiences loved it, where it played for more than 6 months, except in Ireland, where it was banned for the demeaning treatment of women. And for the most part, critics loved it too, seeing Abel's film for its thematic elements more than anything else. In the New York Times, Janet Maslin gave it 3.5 out of 5 stars. When Abel Ferrara calls something bad, you better believe it. He means business. He's come up with his own brand of super sleaze in a film that would seem outrageously, unforgivably lurid if it were not also somehow perfectly sincere. As played by Harvey Keitel, the eponymous bad lieutenant is so far gone he initially seems funny. One condition of Mr. Ferrara's cult status is that his films give as much offense as possible without resorting to much violence, and make no attempt to find the middle of the road. Viewers with little tolerance for over-the-top sensationalism will this time be even further put off than they might have been by Mr. Ferrara's tamer efforts. Mr. Ferrara has his saving graces, too, the chief one being raw talent, which he continues to display while telling even the most far-fetched story. Imagine a Martin Scorsese who had chosen to make nothing but B-movies, and you might have some idea of what Mr. Ferrara can be capable of. Mr. Keitel gives the lieutenant's role his all, which is sometimes more than it requires. At its best, the performance conveys a lost, sardonic character in real pain. Mr. Ferrara's own appetite for sensationalism remains untempered. Even at his most reckless, he continues to indulge it with a lively, low-down version of high style. Owen Gleiberman of Entertainment Weekly gave Lieutenant an A-, calling it shockingly powerful and an exuberantly sordid exploitation movie. He goes on, "Now though, his gutter aesthetic has finally come alive. Ferrara turns the audience into queasy voyeurs. He sends Keitel so over the line that this film becomes a giddy freak show, a squalid comedy of transgression. What's shocking about this dark urban fantasy is that it's driven by a true artist's fervor. As played by Keitel, the lieutenant is the most profoundly depraved movie character since Dennis Hopper's Frank Booth in Blue Velvet. It's more like a comic book psychodrama about a sympathetic evildoer. Ferrara still has problems with pace, but his Catholic obsessions are, in their way, as passionate as Martin Scorsese's. Bad Lieutenant is finally a pulp parable of sin, addiction, and redemption, a movie that, like its subversive hero, revels in the pleasure and danger of going too far." And Robert Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times with 4 out of 4 stars. Harvey Keitel plays this man with such uncompromised honesty that the performance can only be called courageous. Not many actors would want to be seen in this light. This film lacks the polish of a more sophisticated director, but would have suffered from it. They're not interested in plot in the usual sense. There's no case to solve, no crime to stop, no bad guys except for the hero. Keitel starred in Scorsese's first film and has spent the last 25 years taking more chances with scripts and directors than any other major actor. He has the nerve to tackle roles like this that other actors, even those with street images, would shy away from. He bears everything here. His body, yes, but also his weaknesses, his hungers. It is a performance given without reservation, but it is not a dirty movie, and in fact takes spirituality and morality more seriously than most films do. And in The Bad Lieutenant, Keitel's given us one of the great screen performances in recent years. For its home video release, an R-rated cut was created specifically so that Blockbuster and Hollywood Video would rent and purchase out the film since they refused to carry anything above an R. The scene where LT pulls over the two girls from Jersey is almost entirely cut out. Harvey Keitel would go on to win the Best Male Lead Award at the Film Independent Spirit Awards for his portrayal of LT. He would become part of Quentin Tarantino's and Wes Anderson's stable of actors and is one of the most recognizable faces in movies to this day. Abel was nominated for Best Director at the Spirit Awards that year, and would go on to be nominated 3 times at Cannes, including the following year for the Palme d'Or for Body Snatchers. As time went on, Abel drifted into more art house fare, but still stays true to who he is. Randy Sabasawa says he's really proud of Abel for what he did with this film. It's a huge part of our lives that had an impact a ways down the line, he says. The movie didn't make any money, but it wasn't about making money with this one. Script supervisor Karen Kelsall says Abel is the best director she's ever worked with, giving her more opportunities than anyone else has. She says Bad Lieutenant was like lifting a rock and looking at all the bugs. It exposed the world in a way you don't really want to look at it. And about her mentor, she says, "You have to appreciate film as an art to watch what Abel makes. It's disturbing. It makes you think very somber. And in this country, we don't want to watch movies that make us unhappy." On April 16, 1999, Zoe Lund died of heart failure. Her prodigious drug use had finally caught up to her. As for the film, Zoe said the film was what it was to be, and that's all. She said a conscious attempt was made to make it as difficult as possible for the viewer to escape. And of her one-time friend, she said, "People are in love with the concept of an auteur." Abel lives in Italy now, still playing music, still trying to make movies, still doing things his way. He says, "There's a life after the first weekend, and those are the films we're trying to make." Thank you all so much for listening and supporting. It means so much to me. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at AK Donnelly. That's AKDONELLY. My name is Anthony King, and I'll see y'all next time.